Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. A conversation now on what it means to truly know your parents. That's part of what it means to mature, right? You see your parents as individuals with full lives, and that deepens as they and you age. That's a gradual process unless, like Clara Winter, the main character in Allison McGee's new novel, it isn't. Clara's mother has been diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, and so time is short, and mysteries and misunderstandings remain, and Clara isn't sure how to begin. Allison is in the studio with me, and as we talk, I thought it would be interesting to hear from you. If you've been in that place, much to know and say, as a parent faces the end of their life or the end of their memory, how have you begun? Maybe it started with music. Maybe it started with a photograph. Maybe it started with questions that you never dared ask. So if you've been in this family situation where a parent is losing a memory or facing the end of their life and there's still much to say, how did you spark that conversation? How did you begin? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter. I put out a question a little earlier. It's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. Allison McGee's new novel is titled Never Coming Back. It's my book choice for the KM Book Circle. So if you're in the circle, you'll be getting it in the mail. Welcome back. Really good to have you here.
Thanks, Carrie. It's great to be here. I've been well. You?
Good, good. A photograph plays a pretty important role in this new way that Clara starts to see her mother and contemplate her mother's life. And it's really her mother's expression in the picture that is mysterious and intrigues her. Mm-hmm. You've gone back through family photographs. I've had this experience, too, where I think, boy, my grandparents had no idea what was coming for them. It's a fascinating thing to do.
It really is. It's always startling, I think, when you become an adult and you reach that pivot point in your life when suddenly your parents appear to you, and it seems to happen in a moment. They appear to you as people, not your parents, but people. With lives that they had before you entered the picture.
And secrets they aren't going to share with you.
No. And why they don't share them is always, it's a fascinating thing for me to think about. Are they not sharing it because they want to protect you from something? Are they not sharing it because of shame or guilt? Are they not sharing it because they're people with private lives?
Right. I think that's something that you come back and touch on several times in the novel, is what's the child's real right to know,
mm-hmm.
the fullness mm-hmm. of a parent's life, not just before the child came into that life, but the fullness of that life even when you exist and you're in the household. How do
yes.
you think about that?
Oh, I go back and forth. I toggle between my own life as a child growing up with my parents and as a mother of three children who are now grown. And the things that I wanted to know about my parents and the things that I kept about my life from my own children, I go back to a memory I have from, I must have been probably 8 or 9, and I came upon my mother on the phone crying, and it was shocking to me to see my mother cry. She didn't cry much. She was strong. She was stoic, and I watched her just bent in sorrow, weeping on the phone, and then she hung up, and I would have done anything as a child to make my mother happy, to take away her sadness. And I said, Mom, what's wrong? And she jumped. She didn't know I had been watching. And she brushed away the tears and she said, oh, nothing, nothing, honey. And I said, you're crying. And she said, no, no, I wasn't. And I said, I saw you. And she said, you know, I'll tell you when you're older. And I waited. Until I was older, I must have been in my 30s. And I said, Mom, will you tell me why you were crying on the phone? when I was a child. And being my mother with a poor memory to begin with, she said, "I have no memory. I can't help you, honey."
All those years you're waiting to solve
all
the mystery.
Those years.
Right. Some of this, I think, Allison, also happens when a parent's parent dies. I mean, the first time I ever saw my parents mourning and rattled, and more in kind of the fullness of who they were, was when my mother lost her father. I think that's, mm-hmm. and I was young, maybe 10. Mm-hmm. I think that's the first time you think there was a whole life before this.
That is, I'm so glad you brought that up, because it takes me right to an exercise that I do, a writing prompt that I do with my students. And I say, the writing prompt is just a little 10-minute write, but think back to a time when you were a child and you witnessed the vulnerability of an adult.
Oh.
And the room fills with this kind of dark power. And so often and then we go around the room and read out loud. And so often what the students read out loud, and some of these students are, you know, in their 70s, it's about the moment they witnessed their parent finding out that their parent had died.
Wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
It's an incredibly painful and powerful moment. And I think it's just what you said. It's that pivot point where a little window opens and you see your parent as not this invulnerable, powerful force, but as a human being.
The value of that for your students is, I mean, what are you trying to show them? Or have them show themselves, I guess, in that exercise, because that's an intriguing one.
I'm always looking for the points of power in a life, in writing points, in writing prompts. And it's the fullness of human experience, I think. That is one of the most powerful prompts that I know. Sometimes I don't give it, because if the room feels a little fragile that day, it's going to take people to a place where they, in witnessing the vulnerability of an adult, go right back to their own child feeling helpless and lost, like, who's going to take care of me now,
right,
when this adult that I depend on is broken down.
There must be people in those classes that experience that very early on. I mean,
yes,
you know how many children end up, even as kids, as teenagers, being the adult,
yes,
in the house,
absolutely,
taking care of an adult who isn't responsible, can't be responsible.
A lot of addiction, a
right,
lot of abuse, and children often shoulder these enormous burdens at very early ages.
I'm interested in you deciding to talk about early onset Alzheimer's. I mean, you had a lot of choices to create a scenario here for Clara where she would come back home to be,
yes,
with her mother.
Yes.
It's an interesting choice to choose a disease like this that comes on in people's late 40s and 50s. So why?
This is going to sound all woo-woo, and I'm really not that kind of a person, or that kind of a writer. But when I began writing this book, it was initially about a troubled relationship between a parent and a child. I think it began as father-son. That was pretty much all I knew about the book, and I was feeling my way in. And then suddenly, maybe a few weeks into the writing, a voice took over the book. And it was the same experience I had when I was writing my novel, Shadow Baby, a long time ago. The voice took over, and I realized that the voice was going to tell this book that it was somewhat out of my control. And the first scene that appeared was a scene in which a young woman was holding a carton of orange juice and dangling it in front of an older woman who looked confused and a little angry. And it came to me in that minute that this was a scene in which a daughter was realizing that her mother was experiencing a sort of inversion of memory, that she was losing her memory, And it turned into early onset Alzheimer's, and I really had nothing to do with that decision. I didn't want it, actually. It's a very painful disease. It's a shockingly painful
disease. How much do you know about it?
I don't know much personally, but at this point in my life, I'm middle-aged. A lot of my friends' parents are dealing with dementia mm-hmm. or late onset Alzheimer's, which is typical. A couple of friends of mine do have parents who are diagnosed with early onset, and I interviewed them pretty extensively. And there's a couple of moments in my own life when my children were young and I was at a soccer game that I spoke with strangers about their spouses' early onset. And
really?
They had a big effect on me, just those passing moments of speaking with a stranger. The looks on their faces have always stayed with me.
I mean, more than, and I don't know why this is, but more than a terminal disease or something, it feels...
It robs you of
cool.
something. It is.
Why?
It's crueler. I think because with a terminal disease, let's say cancer, you hold on to your memories. You hold on to the right. life that you've lived.
Who you are.
Who you are, that sense of who you are. And I was bedeviled in this book. It brought up all kinds of questions for me, the questions that Clara is asking throughout. When your memories begin to go, do they go somewhere? Is there a place inside you somewhere that we don't know yet where they still are? When you don't remember these seemingly fundamental passages of your life, are you the same person? It's these questions haunt me.
I see, my instinct is to say, if you don't have your memories, then you're, so much of your identity is missing.
Right.
And yet I'd hate to think that you're not the same person, but what are you, right?
Where have you gone?
Right.
No, and I don't have answers. I have a sort of unreasoning faith that somewhere we are who we are and we go on as we are, but that's just a faith. It's not based on reality or fact.
Allison McGee is with us in the studio. If you've just joined us, we're talking about some of the ideas and themes that she develops in her new novel, Never Coming Back. It's about a 30-something woman who goes back home to be with her mother, who is dealing with early onset Alzheimer's, and these questions about identity and memory and who ends up being the keeper of the memory. And I don't know, just watching what that's like to have a beloved parent or family member slip away, that identity slip away with memories. And I was asking here at the beginning of the conversation, if you've been in that place in your family, you've used, I don't know, photographs and music. This is something that Allison writes about in the novel. Maybe some of these questions, maybe the fear of a question to ask it with a parent who is facing the end of a life or facing dementia. If that's something you've experienced in your life, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at Carrie NPR. You started to say something. What were you going to say?
Oh, when you mentioned music, music is, maybe it's the most primal of our senses, that hearing, that memory. Think of all the lyrics that we know by heart. When the idea of memorizing a poem sometimes feels so overwhelming, you can just sing hundreds and hundreds of songs without thinking. And I know that with people who are dealing with Alzheimer's, music is often a huge comfort. Just hearing songs from their childhood, it tends to rob our memories backward. You know, I think a memory is in a vertical stack.
Do you?
Well, after writing this book and doing some research, and often those songs that we loved when we were children are a great comfort.
You have this lovely paragraph as Clara is, the daughter, is trying to understand what her life with her mother, Tamar, was and what it's going to mean that she ends up being the keeper of the memories. And it says, I thought back to those nights when she was pretending to be the spelling bee judge and I was pretending to be the spelling bee contestant, each of us needling the other, sitting there at the kitchen table. And I thought, was that the time in my life when everything was beautiful and nothing hurt and I didn't even know it? Every adult has that.
Yes.
has those watershed moments, right?
Yeah.
Where you think it was all good.
Yeah.
Why didn't I recognize that?
And I didn't know it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's painful to think about. And I think it's part of growing up. We pass through stages of our lives unknowingly. And it's only in looking back that you think, that was a whole time of my life. And I was so busy, or I was so stressed, or I was so unknowing that it was so beautiful. I think parents experience that a lot. When your children are so small, you're running around, you're frantically busy, you're just dealing with the minutiae of and logistics mm-hmm. of physical care of your children. And I have a distinct memory of one day when I was with my son, who must have been about three, and I decided, I had planned this day, that I was going to go at his pace the entire day and not ever once say, hurry up, or, oh, we have to do this.
That's good.
I was just going to follow him around, and we were in the backyard, and it was spring, and the ferns were beginning to unfurl, and he bent over, he put his hands on his knees, and he just laughed and laughed and laughed. And I said, what are you laughing about, honey? And he said, look at the ferns. They're like dragons because of the unfurling long curl of their neck. And I've always remembered that. And yet how many memories do I have like that because I was the busy, overwhelmed young mother?
Right. I was just talking about this with a friend who's in her 30s, and maybe this is kind of impossible, but to say, savor, don't be so caught up in, I could be disappointed here, or this may not work out like I thought,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
to really, if it's possible, to savor the possibility
mm-hmm.
and grab onto that in a way that I think most of us don't do in our 30s and 40s.
I had a hard time doing it,
though
I all those cliches about the journey being the destination, they're all true.
Yeah. Let me grab a call here from Jessica in Lakeville. Hi, Jessica. Sounds like this has been an experience in your family.
Similar. My 1-year-old son had a really devastating traumatic brain injury, and he's only one, so it's kind of the opposite of a parent, actually, because we don't really... We only knew him for like a year, right? And then all of a sudden, everything is gone. Everything is broken. And we see these little bits and pieces of his personality peeking through, but not the way that it was. And it certainly didn't come all back at once. And I really just wanted to tell the author that I think people really are who they are already. And it doesn't necessarily go away when your memory is gone. I mean, we've seen him... He started from nothing, and he came back. I mean, he hasn't come all the way back, absolutely not even close. But we've seen pieces, and the first thing we saw was music. He responded. He opened his eyes, and he was calm for, like, the first time
ever. Oh, that's so beautiful.
Jessica, thank you.
Thank you.
With Jessica's situation, that's a canvas that mm-hmm. could have been one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Mm-hmm.
And now we'll be something else.
Mm-hmm. You know, first, I'm just sending all good thoughts for the continued recovery of this little guy. And thank you for sharing that story. And Jessica's comment that we are who we are and we always were, I feel that absolutely is true. I sensed who each of my children were before they were born, and they were born that way. They really have not changed. And I have a strange memory, which I'm sure people would not believe, but I remember being born, and I remember...
Wait a minute. What?
I know, it's weird,
what?
Carrie.
Allison, you're saying you remember being born?
I do. I actually remember being
born.
No. No, seriously, I do. I was going down a tunnel toward a light, and everything was warm, and there were little soft bits of metal around my head that kept touching on me and lifting off and touching on me and lifting off, and the feeling was inevitability. And it was, here we go again. That was the feeling. And I've had this memory my whole life. You know, when you're going to sleep or just waking up, sometimes those very primal memories come to you. And once I said to my mother, you know, honestly, I swear I remember being born. And she laughed, because everyone laughs. And I don't blame them. And I said, but here's the thing I don't get. There are like these soft sensations of metal all around my head and face. And she got a look on her face and said, well, they did pull you out with forceps.
Forceps, yeah.
Yeah. So I just leave that there for
okay.
you.
Okay. A call here from John in El Paso, Texas. Hi, John. Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Hi. Good morning. What a terrific show and a terrific author. I wanted to tell you that this has really struck a chord. I'm the youngest of three sons, and my mother was a woman of tremendous, I would say a giant intellect. She lived a long life, and I was the go-to caretaker as the youngest child, and I watched her as she began to develop the symptoms of Alzheimer's, and I remember how absolutely shocked it was for me. There wasn't really anybody around who could counsel or guide me or talk to me. I didn't have any friends or acquaintances who had gone through a similar thing, but the last 2 years of her life, she had the natural physical decline that all of us will have and that she had as well, but it was the mental decline that was so absolutely appalling. And I looked at this woman who had been an intellectual, a reader, a member of Mensa, a very thoughtful, dynamic woman, to suddenly become so helpless and to watch as the memories faded. It was the most painful thing I've ever been through, and it's been 3 years since she passed away, and I still have vivid, sharp, and painful memories of her last 2 years. Oh. And I really appreciate the conversation this morning. It's bittersweet in a way. I remember all the good things about her, but the last 2 years were absolutely terrifying, and makes one think. I'm a 60-year-old man now thinking, is that what awaits me and the rest of us? But I want to thank you for the subject, for the conversation. That's interesting and cogent and emotional. I look forward to reading the book, and I thank you.
Thank you, John.
There's a moment when Clara is, again, the daughter, for listeners who haven't read the book yet, is hearing from a close friend of her mother's, and about what she would say about Clara. Here's another super poignant moment as a daughter. And Annabelle, the friend, tells Clara that her mother came to believe that she couldn't match Clara's intellect. And Annabelle says that what her friend Tamar said is, my daughter is beyond me.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean... do you think a lot of parents come to that realization?
I think certainly in this situation, that is how Clara's mother felt, that she could not keep up with or even help her daughter with the wild, big questions she was always asking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it happens with most parents. There is something that your child needs that maybe you cannot figure out how to give them. And you want to give them everything. You want to open the world to them and help them through everything. I know that when my children first experienced heartbreak, like everyone does, it was so overwhelmingly painful for me.
For you.
And my best friend Ellen and I always say, if only we could just cut it in half. You know, we would just take half. They'd experience it. You know, they'd have to go through it, but we could just do half of it. And you can't. You can't.
I thought you made an interesting choice here about when Clara comes back to the Adirondacks, where her mother's been living pretty simply. She's reconnecting with two very close friends from college. Mm-hmm. And it was provocative to me that you brought Clara back to what becomes a triangle again.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
she feels disconnected, it sounds like, from much of her life. I mean, she's got friends where she's living, but mm-hmm. not the kind of friendship. And yet you made a decision that she would rejoin this couple. And in some ways, she'd still be on, in some ways, the outside, I guess, of the essence of the bond mm-hmm. between the two. I mean, this is mm-hmm. how I thought of it.
Yeah.
Did you think of it that way or not?
In a way, I did. Clara is, she's a lonely person.
Right.
She may not feel herself to be lonely. She may feel herself to be fiercely independent and an independent thinker and an adventurer, and she is all those things. But in my view, she is also a lonely person who doesn't really know how lonely she is. And she has these two best friends, Sunshine and Brown, and her relationship with them is similar to my relationship with my best friend. Not everyone has a best friend.
Mm-hmm.
I do. And I've always thought, what would I do without her? Who would know everything about me?
But these are best friends who are their own couple.
They are their own couple. And Clara, and yet they are the kind of couple who just open their arms to this, to their friend. They hold nothing back. They have been through so much together, this threesome. And about a third of the way through the book, the bartender enters the picture. So it's not always a triangle. The bartender works his way in.
I have to thank you again for your poem of the week. I still get it. I don't know if you know I'm still on your poem of the week.
You'll always be on it.
Thank
Whoever
you.
Joins it never leaves.
All right. That's right. Once you check in, you never check out.
That's correct.
Poem of the week. You sent that beautiful Mary Oliver poem a few weeks ago about
the dog.
Her dog, Luke.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love that
it's
poem.
It's been in my head.
Yeah.
Ever since then.
Do you have dogs, Gary?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And I have an aging dog. And
so do I.
And those
14
poems,
and a half right now.
There you go. Those
yeah.
poems, I don't know how you choose them, but they seem to hit just when they should.
You know, you're not the only one who says that. I hear that once in a while. I'll open up an email that says, I was just praying that the poem this week would be the one I needed, and it was. And I'm so glad.
And it's, I mean, there's no rhyme or reason for this, right? There's how you choose.
I have one criterion, and the criterion is I have to love that poem, and that's it. So I don't try for equality in gender or form of poem or subject matter. It just has to be a poem that, as Emily Dickinson, I think, said, makes the top of my head come off.
I'll think of you saying that when I open up my poem of the week.
There you go.
Thank you for that. I wanted to close with a musician that appears in Never Coming Back, and that's Leonard Cohen.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you, Allison. It's
thank
so
you,
good to
Carrie.
See you again. Thank you.
Lift me like an olive branch.